The hole that I am dreaming of is one of the newest par fours on tour, super technical backhand or forehand line off the tee, very wooded. You're going to need to progress about 400 feet off the tee pad. Whether you throw the forehand or the backhand, it's going to have to basically have a full flight. Then the second shot goes up over a little hill and then back down, probably another 200 feet. The basket is situated on a peninsula, although it feels like an island, mainly because of the OB ditch in front. And another note about this hole is that recently they added a new long pin position in order to make the hole a par five for two of the 4 days of the tournament.
Maybe hole nine?
Bing, 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 bing.
Oh my God, you had me lost.
In a different universe.
Maple Hill 9. The only reason I got that was because of the alternate par 5. Before that, I was at freaking Idlewild.
Did you say it was one of your favorites?
It's just one of like the newer par 4s that I thought of on the course. But you know, it's funny when you guys are describing these to me, I always close my eyes so I can get a better image of what's going on in my head. So as I was describing this, I had my eyes closed, and then I looked up at you guys, and I could tell you were lost.
I had my eyes closed.
And so because of that, basically, I knew I had to throw in a little extra hint, so that's why I added the par five.
Well, a point goes to Simon. How does it feel? Congratulations.
I needed that point. I felt like, I don't know, the last two or three rounds, I felt like I'm useless at this game and I have no more chances. But if you take my home course, you know, maybe I'll figure it out sooner than later.
You got it for your own Maple Hill street cred.
Yeah, we're back in the winter. How's it feel?
Yeah, that's a good point. I forgot that it was winter, honestly. The weather was so nice down in Florida, mid-70s and sunny. And then I come back to Colorado and I'm cold again. So I feel slightly disappointed that I had to return to the Arctic. But I'll be back in Texas soon enough with hopefully good weather. I know the next event is Waco, and Waco has a history of being very inconsistent and potentially very cold, but I think the weather's looking good as of right now. But I would just, whenever I say Waco, I just expect Joey to take over, because Joey loves Waco.
Yeah, Joey is in Waco.
There we go.
I am in Waco. I spent the better part of the last 3 days making my way from Tampa Bay over to Dallas, Texas, and now Waco. And on my way, I stopped at another Paul Macbeth, Dylan Cease co-owned, or rather, Paul just designed this course. Dylan co-owns it, called Cactus Rock in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. I have gone there. This was my third visit to the property, and easily, in my opinion, soon to be a course that I hope everybody has on their bucket list courses to play. It is going to be one of the best courses, in my opinion, maybe in the entire world when it is done.
So you're saying it's going to be the best course in the world?
I think it has potential. I mean, essentially, the first time I ever went to the property was in 2023 with Finding the Lines for Disc Golf Network, and I got to meet the three brothers who co-own the property with Dylan Cease. So Dylan essentially bought this land north of Tuscaloosa, and the deal is that these three brothers, the Williams brothers, Nick, Nate, and Nigel, essentially develop the course into a premier level disc golf destination, and in return they get 50% of ownership of the property. So when I first saw the course in 2023 with Avery Jenkins and Paul, it was super rough, but I saw the potential. It is one of the most amazing pieces of property for disc golf. And then the guys that are in charge of essentially stewarding this property, they're basically the perfect dudes for this project. They have a landscaping company in Tuscaloosa called With His Hands. So their entire working lives are spent around molding and landscaping beautiful yards and gardens and other projects. So a disc golf course was basically right up their alley. And yeah, they've spent the last 2 years basically cutting this course out of the thick Alabama woods. And from what I understand, it's basically 50% complete. These guys have a gigantic vision of how to take this from more than just a disc golf course into truly a disc golf event spectacle.
Dang. So how middle of nowhere is this place? Like, I've never been in that area. And is it more middle of nowhere than Olympus, or is it a little less middle of nowhere?
I would say that compared to Brooksville, Tuscaloosa is definitely a much larger city. Brooksville kind of felt like more of a town, definitely like a small town, but Tuscaloosa is a university city.
Roll Tide.
That's right, University of Alabama. So it's only about 25 minutes north of Tuscaloosa.
Oh, okay, that's not bad.
Yeah, and then if you were able to get a hotel, probably on the north side of the metro, it might only be about a 15-minute drive. But it is crazy how fast you go from urban setting into the middle of nowhere. I think something I didn't realize about that area of Alabama is how much elevation exists. And it is crazy how fast it feels like the middle of nowhere out there. But I assure you that once these brothers have their plan in place or finished, it is going to be probably in my top three properties in the world to play disc golf.
That's crazy. That's really crazy because my legs were sore after playing Olympus. Some people argue that Olympus is more challenging to play than a toboggan. So that's saying a whole lot.
Yeah, it is definitely for me. Like, I had a bit of a time comparing that essentially between the elevation. And I know we have a lot of elevation at Olympus, but I seriously think that Cactus Rock might potentially blow it out of the water as far as elevation goes. And it has been super awesome to see kind of the steps that these guys took. Essentially, you know, Paul came through at the very beginning and really kind of designed the course out of nothing and basically selected all the trees and told these guys, you know, have at it. And when you say jump, the Williams brothers say, how high? And the last 2 years, they have really transformed that property. They've seeded grass. They've done hours and hours, probably hundreds of hours of work just on figuring out how the course drains when it rains. They told me that they actually would go out during rainstorms at the beginning and just sit on the fairways in their little skid steers and watch how the water kind of flowed off of the fairways and then essentially molded a bunch of little streams and diversions to kind of keep that property basically water-free. And the next 2 years of their plan essentially is to build stadium seating on 15 or 16 of these holes and clear out a lot of the line of sight for spectators.
When are they ready?
Well, I would say they've spent probably 2.5 years on the disc golf side of the property. I would imagine with the goals that they have in mind and sort of what I've talked to them about the times that I visited, probably another year or two. As you guys know, it's more than just 18 good holes of disc golf that you need on a property. You need a whole venue. You need everything that the Pro Tour demands. You need parking, you need restrooms, you need signal, obviously, for a disc golf network. You need a place for the vendor village. You need a place for the players to warm up. So I think there's definitely maybe as much left to do as what they've done so far. But obviously, it's really exciting because the disc golf side of it is essentially done. So I have had the pleasure of going out the last two seasons right in between chess.com, now the Supreme Flight Open, and Waco. And I have spent a few days each year hanging out with the Williams brothers, and I was able to bring a couple friends last year, and this year I was also able to bring my friend Eli Swanson out to check out the course, and everybody that I've taken has absolutely loved it. The final steps are happening actually this week on Friday. As at the point of this episode releasing, I imagine it already has happened, but Paul McBeth is also making a stop on his way out from Florida to kind of select. There's probably about 15 trees left across the 18 holes that the brothers have basically been waiting for Paul to come and make those final decisions. But once that's done, essentially the course would be 99% ready for tournament play.
Perfect. More really tough disc golf courses.
Yeah, it's not easy.
I mean, I'm looking forward to playing.
I'm excited.
I can't wait. Hopefully next year, when I'm hitting the road with my whole family, we can make the stop.
That's some spicy news. Are you doing the OG Nate Sexton where you buy a giant motorhome and go out on the road?
I mean, we might lease one or rent one. I don't really know what would make the most sense for us. I haven't honestly fully looked into it, but it's just an idea right now. Before the kids hit the school system, to take them on the road for a season or half a season or whatever it would be. Just to, I don't know. I've been with my wife now for almost 8 years, and she's never really had the opportunity to road trip or travel properly because she had a job first, and now we have two little kids. So I feel like kind of I just want to do it, and I feel like next year might be my best chance to do that.
If things go well with your new videographer, Dustin, would he have a room in the RV?
Yeah, we would be the new family.
Uncle Dustin?
New family channel on YouTube. Yeah, I don't know. That is obviously to be determined. Probably not, but there's hotels and Airbnbs everywhere that he can stay in. So
that's a good...
Or he could be our driver and then sleep in the car. Where...
There you go. There you go. That'd be a tight fit for...
Eagle knows what route I would...
Simon would go super luxury RV.
That is accurate.
Simon wants to be longer than Paul McBeth.
Yeah, is there a longer? That thing was as long as it gets.
So Paul's old RV that Jeff Corns
I would get something along
was a 40-footer, or that was a fifth wheel. And that was pretty good size. And I don't think you'd really want anything smaller than that for your whole family. So you're looking at least 40 feet. 40 feet of road real estate.
Oh, yeah. I would buy a boat, as they call it.
And a car to tow behind.
Yes. Emmy is actually turning out to be a phenomenal child. And I think in a year from now, he'll be the most well-behaved, good kid you've ever met.
I wouldn't expect less from the son of Simon Lazat.
Yeah. I think we're doing an all right job for now. But we'll see.
Wow.
We'll see.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about the Supreme Flight Open. And we mentioned Dustin, Simon's videographer. How did Supreme Flight Open go for you on the course and off the course, managing and really getting the groundwork set for what your new tournament series on your channel is going to be like, Simon? How was that whole experience for you?
It was pretty good. It was way more work than we anticipated. Obviously, Dustin has never worked with me like that before. And when two people have slightly different ideas of what they want to make, then it's kind of hard instantly to find compromises or just kind of choose which idea you're going to go with. And yeah, I was just obviously overseeing kind of what he was doing the entire time. And the edits took between 2.5 and 5 hours. So it was always a lot of work. And we ended up being up pretty late and getting up pretty early to like finish the upload and the thumbnail and the title and the description. And, you know, all these little things you got to do to kind of finish your YouTube project, even outside of just the edit itself. But I think overall, I mean, caddy duty wise, everything was fine. Filming with the phone was turned out to be kind of no big deal for us and kind of worked out fine. I played pretty well. I guess that helped the cause a bit. So I had late tea times, which was nice. It gave us a lot of time in the morning to get ready and get the stuff done from last night as well. And yeah, there were a couple hiccups, but I think it'll only get easier and better and faster. I mean, I think in a couple of weeks from now, I'm not going to have to watch what he does at all anymore. And he's just kind of going to do his thing and I can do my thing. And it'll be kind of easier for him to kind of just lock in and do his thing and easier for me because I don't have to be up till 1 in the morning worrying about every little clip.
Right. You'll establish more of a synergistic relationship. I think that's normal though. But I mean, I'm watching the videos. I think they came out really good. And it seems like the response was super solid from them. And the goal is one video a day, even on the practice days, or just every day you're at the location of an event, right?
Yeah, it depends what we get. It depends what the plans are. But the main idea is to do one, like, warm-up practice round or practice days kind of video. So if it's more than one practice day, then that would probably be all within one video. And then one video for each tournament round. So either 3 or 4. And for Worlds, 5. And then in an ideal world, we would even have one extra video per week that would be like a different course vlog or some challenge that we can do at the Airbnb or something, just separate that can be posted in the off week that follows the tournament week, which on Monday after Supreme Flight Open, actually, we went down to Tampa and filmed 9 holes with Ken Climo.
That's insane.
I mean, that video is probably dropping tomorrow. I'm actually going to check the edit right after we're done recording here.
What was that like?
Was that clips?
Was unbelievably wild. No, we actually played Picnic Island.
Oh, I was looking at that on UDisc. That place looks pretty cool.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. It got pretty heavily destroyed by the hurricane, so I think they were still repairing some of the fairways, but we played like a 9-hole loop that Climo kind of decided that would make sense for the video and for our flow. And some crazy things happened during that round. It was, you know, sometimes you're on the vlog just trying to make something happen and nothing works. And in this case, it was the opposite. Everything happened and everything worked. And I'm excited for people to see it. And it was really fun. And afterwards, we went to his house. He gave us a little tour. He just inherited his wife's parents' house, and it's a super cool spot, and there's so many insane stuff in this house because his wife's dad was like, he went on like all these trips to Alaska, and he had all these friends from like hunting trips. And
did they have any woolly mammoth tusks?
What
did they have any woolly mammoth tusks?
No, I don't think so. Maybe.
Dang, that'd be sweet if they did.
Well, they had a lot of things, and then his garage was also crazy with all this old really cool stuff. And then I played 9 holes of golf with Ken Climo and Brad Hammack.
Wow.
It was absolutely, I mean, that was legendary. It was absolutely legendary.
That 9 holes of golf you'll never forget.
No, and I mean, the craziest thing was Brad's first shot, the hole one was a par 3, and I don't think I've ever seen a ball getting so close to a hole in one in person. Like, I think he missed the cut by like literally an inch. It was It was a magical round. And I mean, Climo and Brad go back, I don't know, 35 years probably, doing all, and for them, everything's a competition. Everything is just like has to be just as serious as it gets. And they just go back and forth with their smack talk. And I mean, just watching them go back and forth after all these years is, it was a pretty monumental experience.
Yeah, I mean, for those who don't know the Brad Hammack story, when I worked with Jomez in 2022 and 2023, I spent a lot of time with Brad because he was around. And I mean, I knew who he was before I met him, so I was kind of aware of the Masters world titles accolades, but I didn't really know a lot about his pre-Masters experiences. I knew he had toured, but I asked him basically, and he told me that, you know, when he started, he really started looking up to Climo, because Climo was the guy, even when Brad had started kind of playing competitively, and he sort of idolized Kenny, and then eventually, and was learning from Kenny, and kind of was this, like, protege, even though they're similar in age. He was definitely, like, kind of watching Kenny and mimicking him, and then, you know, eventually getting good enough to where he was battling with this guy for world titles. I mean, if anybody ever runs into Brad Hammack and you want some good stories, just ask him about 96 and 97 world championships. I mean, he'll tell you how close he was against the champ, the guy that he had idolized for so long. And yeah, he's had a really storied career. But yeah, that is a really interesting relationship between the two of them. I actually saw them coming off the course after round one, just talking and from a distance, and I whipped out my phone and got a video because I could hear them deep in the middle of like some old story, and you could just tell that they were just like talking about some battle they had like 20 years ago, and you could just see how great it was for both of them to kind of see each other and reminisce about that stuff. And I mean, those dudes were the Ricky and the Paul of the late 90s.
Yeah, that's exactly how the entire golf round went. They would pull up some shot or some day or some event that happened 25 years ago and just go back and forth at it for 5-10 minutes about each little shot and like what they were feeling in that moment and how they will never forget these battles from the late 90s, early 2000s. Pretty wild stuff. Sometimes I wish I had a memory like that where I could just remember rounds I played, and like that's barely 10 years ago. I feel like sometimes I don't even remember who I played with two years ago.
Simon and I had dinner with UC when he came to Virginia for Worlds, and it was so funny because UC was putting us on the spot. He was just asking us, tell us a story, and both Simon and I don't really have a lot of stories in the forefront of our mind. And we just were like, I don't know. We were trying to figure out stuff. But yeah, it just, I've always wanted to become a better storyteller, but my brain just doesn't pick up on stories of places I've been, because obviously we've been on the road for over 10 years and we should have a lot of stories, and we probably do if we've really thought about it. But man, some people just live to tell those things, like Avery, Joey, and obviously Kenny. But yeah, it's really interesting to hear some of the old guard and what happened to them and where disc golf originated from.
You know who one of my favorite storytellers is?
Who's that?
Barsby.
Casey White. Well, Barsby's great too, honestly. That's, I mean, almost the same type of storyteller, but Casey White was my pick. But honestly, listening to both of them, especially Barsby, because of how well he knew Kenny, like listening to Barsby do Kenny, doing his impersonation, it's so good. But also Casey's Kenny is good. Like I listened to him tell a couple Kenny stories this past week at Supreme Flight, and Casey has that same passion, and he did a really good Kenny impression, and I was I don't know. There's something about just like the passion for essentially taking the mundane and turning into something interesting. That's what makes a good storyteller, because you have to find, you have to essentially not embellish or exaggerate, but you do have to make the things that maybe aren't interesting. I mean, there's a way to tell the story that's boring, and there's a way to tell it that's really encapsulating.
Yeah, quick funny thing. We were on the putting green warming up before our golf round, me, Climo, and Brad. And this other guy walks up who is not a disc golfer, doesn't know who any of us are, but just somehow starts talking to Brad. I don't know why, if it was like the shirt he was wearing or something, if he overheard us like talking about disc golf or something. And then I don't know how it happened, but somehow the next second I look over, Brad is like fully talking about some disc golf tournament from 25 years ago with this guy he just met. And he goes like full into character and it's like doing like a full performance basically on how epic this one throw was from 25 years ago and the crazy battles him and Climo used to have from a guy he just met like 2 minutes ago. And I was just kind of watching the show and I was like, wow, these guys are, I mean, that's what they live.
Entertainer.
They live for telling their stories. Yeah, totally.
I mean, that is part of like doing all those adventures too, though, is that like, I mean, I will say like, whenever you kind of come across those like kind of quintessential like old storyteller guys who like it seems like all they want to do is tell you like stories about their past and all that, I just look at myself too and I think like that is going to be me. Like that's going to be me in 40 years. Like once you're physically
unable, that's you right now.
Same. Sure, but like, but I tell stories like, you know, they aren't all like 30 years ago, basically. They're not all these like memories that are long ago from when I was in my 20s, in my prime. And I just have a level of respect for that because I know that I feel like for me, at least, a part of the reason that I like to do all this is for the memories that I get to make and the stories that I will get to tell. Because I grew up with a dad who was pretty adventurous guy when he was young and shares my extrovertness and also shares my love for telling stories. And so I grew up with a dad who just had all, every week it sounded like, it felt like we had heard this new adventure from Mike Tamale that I didn't know about the time that he hitchhiked to this state or the time that he went backcountry skiing here. And so I kind of grew up idolizing the fact that I wanted to also be that dad who one day has all these cool stories to tell. So when I run across a Brad Hammock, or even sometimes when you're in a rush and you don't have the time to listen to the full story, like I still try to like give it its time of day because I know that it's really important to Brad because that was his whole life. And you know, part of that now is passing that on, those experiences to us.
You're going to be the cool elder, the cool dad, the cool uncle, the cool guy.
I think you already have it, Joey. I don't think you need to grow into it. I think you already have it.
You're already meant to fill that archetype.
That's right. That's right. Well,
it's your destiny.
I mean, you have a great memory.
Yep. And I've had lots of crazy fun experiences that definitely lend to helpful, fun stories.
Speaking of stories, how was swimming with manatees?
Oh, yeah, that was something else. I final round Sunday, I chose to go up to Lake George, which is about an hour and a half north of our Airbnb where we were staying, with the guy who was supposed to caddy for me, a local that I met named Ryan. I met him at Cliff Stevens the week before, and nice guy. Just a few years older than me. He lives in Tampa for the last 5 years and he has a handyman business. And then his two hobbies are playing disc golf and free diving. So he showed me his Instagram and I was looking through his Instagram and it was insane. These videos that he had on his Instagram, he was either like swimming with manatees or swimming through these little crevasses underwater. And it just looked interesting. And there was tons and tons and tons of these videos. So I gathered basically through that this guy knows what he's doing. How can he not? And so I asked him if there was any ability to still see the manatees, because for those who don't know, the manatees spend most of the year in the ocean near the shore, But in the winter, when the ocean cools down, the manatees come inland into a multitude of freshwater springs all across Florida. But around this time of year, they start to head back out to the ocean because the water is warming up. So I asked him basically if there was any spots that might still have some manatees left. He picked a spot. He picked me up Sunday morning. We went out there. He had a spare little wetsuit for me and a spare snorkel. And I mean, it was magical. It was unbelievable. It was one of the coolest experiences I've had with other big animals like that. And the water was unbelievably clear. I mean, it was almost like you could see better underwater than you could see above the water. I mean, that's not true, but it felt like there was no loss of visibility, basically, when you poked your head underneath, and it was just like a whole other world under there. So it was super cool. And then the day after that, actually, Monday afternoon, was our dear friend Albert Tom's birthday, 27 years old. And we went to a different spring with Bradley and my friend Eli and Albert and Calvin Heinberg. And we kayaked on Silver Springs. This one you weren't allowed to go swimming. It was a more protected area, but the water was just as clear. And we actually saw even more manatees that day than we did the first day. So truly very special Florida wildlife experience. Definitely something I had been wanting to do.
How big are they?
I mean, they're like the size of cows, basically. If you took the legs off of a cow, I mean, they are huge. They were, let's just say this, they were as big, if not bigger, than my entire kayak, like in length, when I like poked my head underwater or poked my phone underwater to go see like what was going on down there. And they're so peaceful, and they're just like, they're little bottom feeders. So they basically just float along the bottom, munching up the seagrass, and then every 2 or 3 minutes, they come up to the surface, and they take a big breath in, and it sounds like a whale, basically, so you can almost get scared if you don't see them behind you. It's a pretty loud noise when they poke their head up and take this huge breath in, and then they float back down under the water and keep eating.
And they're generally very docile?
Oh, I wouldn't even, generally might be like too unpredictable of a word. I don't think I've ever seen a manatee be aggressive. I suppose maybe in self-defense, if they
you're not going up and like petting them or anything, right?
You're not allowed to. No, you can't. So the rule in these areas is essentially, if the wildlife approaches you, you can like make contact with the wildlife, but you're not basically advised to go seeking them out and touching them, basically. And so it's the same that applies. The manatees are the only ones I think that you would like be tempted to do that with, because all the rest of them, you don't want to mess around with snakes or gators. Like nobody's like doing that.
No, that sounds sad. I saw some of your stories, and that is on my list if the tour returns to Florida next year, which I'm sure it will. That looks so cool.
Well, and now we know the guy to take us. That's the best part, is now we have this loco who really has a lot of knowledge on the area, the subject. So he basically said if we're down early before the tournament, he's down to take us any day we'd like to go. So I'm definitely looking forward to, hopefully, a Florida start to the season next year.
Definitely. I want to metamorphosize myself from eagle to seagull. I want to partake in a lot more aquatic activities in the future, and that's one of them. I just remember I've only gone snorkeling once. I was in Hawaii for 2 months as a kid, and literally on the last day of being in Hawaii, I went snorkeling, and it blew my mind just seeing all the reefs, all the fish. It's truly a different world, and I want to start exploring that different world, which I'm going to make an effort next year to join you guys, because that sounds amazing.
Emmett would love it.
Yeah, he should come. I mean, and that's the thing. So the place that we went was, they have all sorts of kind of expert locations, you know, caves that are pretty deep and require a lot more experience. But the place that he took me was specifically designed for beginners. And actually, there was a bunch of kids probably a few years older than Emmett, maybe 4 or 5 years old, but lots of kids had little snorkels, and it was a very kind of approachable, beginner-friendly way to kind of like try this out in this freshwater spring. So, and it was also surprisingly warmer than our backyard pool that we had at the Airbnb. I was expecting, because of how crystal clear the water was, that it was going to be ice cold as well, but it was really, honestly, nice swimming water.
Yeah, it's probably like the same temperature year-round since it's spring-fed, right?
Right. And at the back end of the spring that we went to, you could actually go, and because we had the snorkels, you could look down and see the water ripping up out of this crack in the back of this river, basically. And I mean, it was serious amount of pressure coming up, so much so that if you looked at the surface of the water, you could just see like the upwelling, like almost like there's just a huge jet on underneath. And
how big was the crack?
Well, it was big enough for Ryan to fit in, because as I was like taking all this in underwater, I see him just dive straight down towards the crack, grab the edge, and like against the pressure of the water, just force himself into the crack, and he disappeared for like 25 seconds. And so I'm just looking at this crack like 40 feet below my feet underwater, and then all of a sudden he comes flying back out like with the full power of the water behind him, and he shoots straight up to the top, and I was like, oh my gosh, are you all right? He was like, oh, yeah. He's like, I saw like 150 fish back there. It's pretty crazy. They're all sitting back there behind the vent. But wow. It was a human-sized crack in the rock down there.
That's wild. Good podcast name.
What?
Human-sized
crack.
I like it.
Speaking of Florida wrap-up, we had a tournament that finished up. The first event of the year. Very dramatic finish in FPO, a three-way playoff. Big congrats to Ella Hansen taking down her second DGPT win in the first event of 2025. And then in MPO, we had essentially what felt like a pretty scripted first statement win. I mean, all the storylines surrounding Ezra Robinson coming into the tournament was how he's the highest rated player who hasn't won an Elite Series or Major, and it wasn't really that close. And boy, he stepped up and just not only came in and won the tournament, but to shoot course record 12 down, bogey free, final round to win by, was it 7 or 8? I mean, he was ahead by so much that he basically had no risk to run the final 20 footer just to set the course record, because there was no risk of choking his 7-stroke lead at that point. And that's what a way to get the monkey off your back.
Most definitely. Did you watch the coverage?
I mean, I was there. I watched live the last 4 or 5 holes.
I was interested to see what 12 birdies looked like on the course. And my goodness, the way that round started off, let me just say, AB got so unlucky so many times that round, and Ezra, obviously he was playing well, but he had just everything go his way. Like, it was totally Ezra's day. Yeah. AB got a double bogey, 7, on hole number 4, with
triple bogey.
What? What'd you say?
Triple.
It was a triple bogey. Oh, my
gosh.
He had two kicks OB over the fence, and Ezra makes, like, one of the best putts of the year for a 3. And right there, it was like, I mean, if I was Ezra, I'm like, oh, my gosh, let's go. Today's my day. And after that hole, it was just a statement from Ezra.
And then he's a little bit inside on 5, but it works out anyway. Gets all the way up, gets his putt, makes his putt. And then on 7 was the most perfect example of it being Ezra's day and not AB's. Because AB, could not have asked for a better shot on that green. And it just gets
the
up
best
and
shot,
rolls.
Worst roll.
The best shot and the worst roll. And then Ezra throws arguably like a worse shot because it wasn't as... you could argue that that was safer. Sure, but it's like, you know, he plays to the left side, but he doesn't get the roll. And I think he was as likely to have gotten it as AB, and he stays and makes his birdie. And I mean, credit to him. He took advantage of the little fortune here and there. But I do think that it kind of goes back to Simon's point last week about trying to eliminate bad shots getting good results and good shots getting bad results out of essentially like randomness. And, you know, I think the sport still has a way to go in that. But I think, you know, when you go watch around like that, just even the front nine, you can see that on display perfectly at the top, right? Between the two guys battling for the win.
Totally. Like Ezra completely earned it, but it was also his day. And it definitely wasn't AB's day. Because you could make an argument that AB was throwing as good as he needed to, but the results he was getting were just not in his favor in any way.
And then at the same time, you can go look at round two, hole two, and see how he birdies that after essentially shanking his tee shot and getting a double kick to the perfect spot and then executing like one of the longest forehands you'll see ever thrown in a competition round and still gets away with the birdie. So he also had his good fortune moments as well throughout the tournament. But obviously the final round, you know, sometimes it's in the cards and sometimes it's not.
Yeah, I think generally speaking from what I've heard of the podcast after the tournament and kind of, I felt like people didn't quite understand or appreciate how good 10 under is on that course.
10 under is insane on that course.
Yeah, it is literally, you're playing insane and nothing's going wrong. That's how good that is. And that's like literally, like how many people shot double digits? Like four maybe?
And Ezra shot 29.
And they were like putting out of their minds. They were like circle one and circle two 100%. Like they didn't miss.
Yep. No, and then it's not only that, but then you have this battle happening and AB has yet to miss a putt inside the circle going into 14 on the final round, which is insane stat for a guy who I would say is more known for his throwing skills. Not to knock his putting. Obviously, like he proved it that it's come a long way. But to go that perfect and then obviously he has that 30-footer that he airballs on 14 and you can kind of feel like maybe that's it, right? And I feel like Ezra totally did because he steps up and eagles 15 and then birdie 16, like back to back. He goes 3-3. I think every single person on tour would kill to go 3-3 on 15, 16. And then to step up and birdie. Did he birdie 17 too? I don't remember if he birdied out.
He parred it pretty easily.
Okay. But I mean, that was just really impressive to me. After essentially, I felt like that putt on 14 from AB was a game set match. And then Ezra just goes, yeah, okay, cool. Let me just slam the door here real quick.
It's pretty remarkable. Good for Ezra. We're pumped for him. And I mean, right then and there, the Robinson brothers were already cemented as the best brothers ever, but this just kicks it up a notch. Yeah, both brothers have wins on the Elite Series, which is... That's crazy. That is so crazy.
I have to make a special public apology because I got called out on 18 by a fan about my fantasy team because I dropped Ezra Robinson off my team in exchange for Anthony Barella. And I had completely forgotten about that until somebody reminded me on hole 18 as I was signing some discs that I had the winner on my team, and I replaced him for Anthony. So at the moment, I still feel okay.
Have you done point updates? Do we know who's leading? Because my picks, I think, were all pretty good. Obviously, Kristen Tatar is not there, but...
I will have the point updates ready for next episode going into Wake.
Maybe for next... Yeah, for next week.
I like it.
Good, good, good. Yeah, but... I mean, my tournament overall went fine. I shot 6-under, 5-under, 5-under, so it was, like, good, not great. I think I averaged 1046, I want to say, if I looked correctly.
Didn't you say that it was going to be 777 was going to have a chance to win? So you technically missed that by 5. That's not terrible.
Yeah, my goal final round was to shoot 10-under to reach that 21-under, which was my goal. And through 9 holes, I was 7-under par, and I was, like, freaking out. I was just not, for some reason, even though I've won multiple tournaments before and I've played very, very good rounds from start to finish before, But for some reason on that day, I was not mentally prepared to shoot a hot round, and I just completely fell apart on the back nine. But it was good. It was good proof.
What did it feel like, though, on the front? You were just, and in contrary, because I was watching the final round, and it felt like a little bit different than the way Ezra started. You basically were puring everything. I mean, it was, there didn't seem like there was a lot of clenchers on any of your tee shots. You were piping every shot until hole 10, and then it went from, like, hearing everything to just like not even close, like just a total opposite. But I imagine for those first nine holes, you must feel like, I can't do anything wrong. I can do no wrong.
After nine holes, I checked the scores, and I was in third place, like two or three off the lead. And my brain just started spiraling. And I am totally happy to admit that I just was not ready. I'm also okay with it.
Yeah.
I don't feel like I had to be ready then, and I just wasn't ready, and I spiraled back down to sixth place, tied for sixth, finished my tournament with a birdie at least, so that kind of saved my positive attitude at the end of that, because the back nine was honestly pretty insanely bad. Like, I didn't throw one straight throw. They were just all going sideways. It was pretty monumental to save par in some of those holes that I did. But yeah, I think overall it was a positive start for me. My putting was insane. I literally missed zero circle one putts the entire tournament. And I had lots of those circle edge testers. So that was a great surprise. And I'm just happy that this early in the season, my game feels there. My brain just has to kind of catch up.
Did you feel like the reaction to your videos? I'm sure you've watched them all as they've come out. Do you feel like the public reception to all of this was pretty positive overall? I haven't really gone in and looked through the comments or anything like that.
Yeah, I'm definitely not a very active comment reader. I mean, that area of the internet scares me a lot. But Dustin reads some, and my wife always keeps up with that stuff too, and they've said that it's been overwhelmingly positive and people love it. I mean, the views themselves haven't been as up as I was hoping for, but it's also only the first event. It's a new format. It was kind of to be expected that's going to be a bit different, especially with that many frequent uploads. So I'm really hoping to make some more Simon style videos in between these tournament weeks to just see what I can reach with this and see if engagement will go up. But I think everyone who tuned in did enjoy it. And I am pretty sure I can promise that it'll only get better from here, because it was our first try and we're already making adjustments. I already have a bunch of new stuff ordered. I actually went to the Apple store today and bought a new phone just for filming purposes on the course.
Very nice.
Pro Max.
16 Pro Max will be our new device. And we got some new microphones as well. And just overall, things will be a bit more polished moving forward.
Well, everybody, that takes us to the amount of time that we want to sit here tonight.
I want to hear about Eagles tournament, and then we can sign off.
I was thinking of an analogy, because I took 12th, and I'm generally content with it. I feel like obviously some good things happened, but I felt like the whole tournament was more or less a grind and a struggle. And there was a few shots where I flubbed. I missed two inside the circle putts. And my whole ethos for this event was, don't be bothered by anything. And it was so hard to swallow my pride, but I did, and I succeeded very well. I gave my best to my fans after the round, but there's just this aching in your heart. Like, for example, round two, I missed like a 20 footer on 18. That birdie would have been clutch. It would have moved me up a card. It would have helped out virtually everything because every birdie is important out there. And what it came down to, it made me realize this analogy. When you have a blemish on your scorecard, it's kind of like a blemish on your face, a pimple, if you will. You try to tell somebody about your pimple, and it really doesn't matter that much to them. All it is kind of ugly. And all it is kind of ugly, and they have to look at it, but they're like, eh, it's fine. It's just a pimple. It's going to go away eventually. But you have to look
at
the
mirror. Don't pop it.
You have to look at the mirror, and you got to live with it. And you're like, ugh, gosh, what do I got to do to get rid of this? And that's what it felt like. Is like every time I looked in the mirror, no matter how positive I was, I still saw that metaphorical pimple on my face. That said, I only had like one or two pimples the entire tournament. So, all in all, I'm pretty happy with it. I feel like top 15 is kind of the new top 10. And I played a solid event. I threw a lot of good shots. My mind is getting more and more attuned to playing again. And I know what I need to do going out there. But I'd say it's a steady start. And I really enjoyed myself out in Florida. It was a great course, probably a top 10 track for me. And what's most important, I feel like I made a positive impact in Florida when it came to interacting with fans, creating MVP content, and just having a good time for myself. So all in all, a positive experience for me and a great way to kick off the season.
Well, there we go.
There we go. Episode 9 in the books.
Is the episode name a human-sized crack?
Human-sized crack or a pimple on the scorecard?
A scorecard pimple.
I like scorecard pimple.
Or just scorecard pimple. Yeah,
I like it. Awesome, guys.
Well, everybody, thanks for listening. Next episode will be either two of us in person in Texas, or all three of us again remote. It will be the Waco preview episode. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for supporting this show, for supporting each one of us.
We need merch. We need merch.
We need toe socks.
We do need toe socks.
Crushed pepper toe socks.
Oh my gosh. Are we going to make crushed pepper toe socks? Anyway, you guys, thank you so much for listening. Have a great weekend, and we will see you in the next episode.
Good night.
Mwah.
Why is no one talking?
Dead air. This is a real concern in podcasting. Will, media guy.